Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome to the last Damage Report of the week. It's a Friday show. Those are the most exciting shows, usually because gigantic news drops. Not really this time, and so it's exciting for another reason. The week's almost over, yay. I'm John Adirola. Joining me in ending the week, Brett Ehrlich.
Welcome. Hi, it's great to be here.
Host of the Happy Half Hour.
You guys need to watch the Happy Half Hour this week. We have Jonathan Bennett, who played Aaron Samuels in Mean Girls. He has a cookbook out for Mean Girls Day called the Burn Cookbook. And we make a drink from that called the Too Gay to Function Cosmo. And it is really great and fantastic and lighthearted and fun. So you need to watch it. It's on 5 p.m. today. And then subscribe to the podcast. There's another podcast that I've been listening to that's amazing, and I rated 5 stars. It's the Damage Report podcast.
I think I listened to one. I didn't like it.
Oh.
But yeah, thank you for liking
the
it,
the voice of the host is like a little
It's a little bit grating and stupid. But it gets you from both sides. But if you like it, you should go and rate it 5 stars. We'd very much appreciate that. We'd love to hit 1,000 ratings. That would be awesome. And tune into his show because they continue a debate that's been going on for, since time immemorial. Is Fetch going to happen or is it not going to happen?
John Adirola, contributing writer to this episode, because I freaked out and he was like, why don't you just do a Fetch happen thing, but with dogs?
Yes, I contributed, even though it has been made very clear to me that not only do I have no training in comedy, but it would be a waste of time.
It would have been a waste of time to fix it the way you wanted to, because I don't think it would have made it much better.
That's true. Okay. Well, with that said, why don't we jump into at least letting you know what's going to happen? Because not only do we have the big news of the day, we're going to give you an update on Hurricane Michael. We're going to talk about the continuing investigation into the disappearance and likely murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But also, we've got two amazing guests. So, political scientist Mark Hetherington's got an amazing book. It's a Prius or Pickup. And it explains the competing worldviews that are helping to drive not only political polarization, but the increasing cultural divide in America along a few very specific sort of consumer choices, which is very interesting. And then we're going to be joined once again on the show by Ken Klippenstein, TRT Investigates reporter. He has uncovered one of Ted Cruz's national security aides. When you find out who this aide used to work for, it'll blow your mind. And then, most important story of the week, Kanye West and Donald Trump. We're going to be breaking down some of that at the very close of the show. So, you want to jump in?
I would love that.
Let's do that. We're going to start off with probably the saddest story of the day, perhaps. Hurricane Michael has done its damage. Now we're in the period where people are still being looked for. The damage is being surveyed. I've heard it referred to as it looks like the aftermath of a war. It's a war zone. Wow, so amazing. 155-mile-per-hour winds. It hit the community of Mexico Beach at 2 miles per hour short of Category 5. But to the people there, probably didn't really matter. The wind was so strong, it snapped boats in two. It knocked over freight rail cars that weighed 30 tons. It was able to knock them over. And so imagine if you were out and about, or if you're in a vehicle, or if you're in a home, it effectively is no protection whatsoever. Authorities have said that we believe, I think New York Times, the most recent updated account is 13 deaths directly attributable to Hurricane Michael. In Virginia, 7 people at least have died. Several drowned, a firefighter who was responding to an emergency call also killed. And yesterday, there was also a report of an 11-year-old girl, Sarah Radney, was killed when a carport was torn away and sent into the modular home that she was living in.
Yep, she was staying with her grandparents. The father was an hour and 15 minutes away and kept calling. And they said at the beginning it was fine. And what happened was the carport came up and part of it came into their home, punctured the grandmother's lung and killed the girl. Harrowing. It's just a really, really sad story. I always get freaked out by like the coverage that I see a lot on CNN and such, when it's, we take a weatherman and we put them out there and then everyone watches how hilarious it is that the weatherman gets blown away.
Yeah.
But it's tough.
I get it. It is very much a cliche. It's a trope of particularly CNN coverage. mean, I guess, like, they want to show you what it's actually like. And if you don't live along the coast, you don't experience these things. Like, I've never been in a hurricane. I've been to where my mother lives. I've been in the aftermath of a hurricane and seen docks, you know, thrown across bays and things like that. But I guess it is necessary to actually see it in the same way that we send reporters to war zones. But especially considering that these storms are clearly getting worse and more people are dying, sort of the tone needs to shift, I think, a little bit. Because you're right, there is a little bit of that. Will he get hit by something? Will he go flying down the street sort of vibe?
Right.
And people are dying.
And this particular hurricane did give people less time to prepare. Mm-hmm. This is the portion of hurricane season, from what I understand, where those long trains of hurricanes coming across the Atlantic that you can monitor, that is not where they originate from anymore at this point in the season. Now you'll have more hurricanes like the ones that just kind of pop up in the Gulf. Yeah. And as the temperature of the Gulf is, you know, 85 degrees or over, which is the prime recipe for a large hurricane. Yeah. They said that this one, I mean, and this was different from others where I had seen it. They thought maybe it'll be a category 3 when it makes landfall. But by the time it did, it was 2 miles an hour short of a category 5.
Yeah.
And people just didn't have time really to prepare in relation to how much time they had to prepare for previous hurricanes this season.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm glad that you mentioned the temperature, because that's one of the big things, obviously. You know, as you know, every year goes by, every decade goes by, hurricanes are more likely to find the sort of conditions that lead to stronger and stronger hurricanes. And as the sea levels continue to rise, storm surges are going to naturally be worse. As we were talking about with Jess Phoenix earlier this week, it's not a thing where, like, oh, now we're flooded. It's like, hey, we were fine, and then we're flooded. It's one point. It's like as it rises, it makes the conditions worse and worse whenever you have a storm. And so long before communities are unlivable, like permanently, that the water is always at a level where you can't have houses there, it means that you're going to have worse and worse storms. So like we're reporting on Hurricane Michael, but next year it's going to be worse, and it's going to be worse the year after that. And so for many of the people who are going to be returning to these hard-hit areas, they have more hurricanes to look forward to in the future, which is sad.
Yeah.
As of right now, over 1.4 million homes in Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Virginia, and the Carolinas don't have power.
I don't know how to handle it. It's crazy to see the development of the warning systems. Essentially, well, not the warning systems, but like Rick Scott saying, at a certain point, the governor says, you can't leave anymore. Mm-hmm. You had your chance to leave. You have to stay where you are.
Yeah.
What do you do in that situation? And these specific areas of the Florida panhandle have been reported to be the poorest in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you go when you have to leave?
And do you have the resources
You don't to have leave. The resources to leave. And the house that you're in, if it's a modular unit like that, it's going to be less stable than a home with a cellar. Also, this is Florida, so the water table's right there.
Yeah.
You can't really have a cellar.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Some of these areas are going to be increasingly difficult to live in general.
Mm-hmm.
I just really fast mention. One of our producers, Dan, showed this to me, and I thought it was amazing. Beto O'Rourke's Q3 fundraising record. I know that you come to our show for quarterly fundraising reports.
Oh,
no, but really,
it's
amazing. $38 million in one quarter for a Senate race. It's not like a presidential race. Like, that would be great if you were running for president. Especially during the primaries, obviously. This is for one particular state, $38 million. But what makes it even more amazing is he raised those $38 million without corporate PAC money, like the big, reliable source of huge donations that you can normally get. He said about this new record, the people of Texas and all 254 counties are proving that when we reject PACs and come together, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as Texans and Americans, there's no stopping us. I'm going to disagree a little bit with him. I'm sure that a lot of that money came from outside of Texas and probably mostly from Democrats, but it is still amazing. And it shows that you don't need that corporate PAC money to raise a ton of money. What you could use is 800,000 individual contributions, which is what he has had so far, which is amazing. By the way, that's 3 times what Ted Cruz got.
Yes. We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be.
featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And I'm assuming Ted Cruz, probably a good bit of that's coming from corporate PACs.
It's coming from corporate PACs. It's coming from, you know, an establishment fundraising machine that
wealthy
wants
billionaires.
To keep Trump, that wants to keep the Cruz-Trump kind of Republican in power.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fantastic. I know that they try to pose this as, oh, a bunch of Democrats from outside of Texas are swooping in.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cruz can get hit back with the, like, outside of Texas, oh, that's where you're from, Ted.
Oh, no, totally, yeah. No, yeah, that's the thing. Like, so I said earlier that I think Beto was going to say it's going to come just from Texas. No, a lot of these donations come from outside of it. But, yeah, the vast majority, I mean, we showed the chart of the outside spending for Ted Cruz just skyrocketed over the past couple of months.
Right, because there's...
he needs that.
The way that it works is you have a machine that's looking around, they have their money, and they say, that race is fine. We don't really need to up our payments on that race. And then when they see that there's like a leak in the boat over in Texas, they're like, all right, plug it with cash.
Yeah, and for comparison, in Arizona, the Democratic candidate raised $7 million. So huge difference. Obviously, Texas is a bigger state too, but that is huge. Doesn't mean he's necessarily going to win. God help you if you're in Texas and you don't go and vote and bring people with you. But it certainly means that he at least has the ability to get his message out. With that said, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, Mark Hetherington, a political scientist and author of an awesome book, is going to join us. We're hoping to learn a lot after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So we talk about political polarization quite often on this program, but it is possible that we've been getting some of the fundamentals wrong. We're going to be joined now by author and political scientist Mark Hetherington, who's going to help break it down for us, perhaps correct some of our misconceptions. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. You're the author of this book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. I want to understand that divide a little bit better. So in your book, you talk about, like, we like to think of ourselves as complex individuals who make choices without reference to other things. But you've identified some pretty core ways that we sort of sort ourselves into competing worldviews. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, the thing that's so interesting about politics today is that it's so different from how it used to be. So when you think about pretty much everything that we know as scholars, it's premised on the idea that people don't really care about politics very much. And we look around these days and we think to ourselves, boy, it seems like we care almost too much about politics. The polarization is so overwhelming. And the reason is because of the things that we're divided about. The things that we're divided about because they're race and because they're immigration and gender equality and things along those lines. Those ideas are driven by our worldviews, you know, how dangerous we think the world is, how open to new ideas we are. And that's a lot different from how it used to be when the dividing line used to be how much government we ought to have. Should government do more programs or fewer? So as a result, we have this politics that's just much more visceral, much deeper down inside of us. And in fact, you know, the evidence is that we're making decisions about politics probably before conscious thought even begins.
So you talk about, obviously, in this, you've got, you know, the four simple questions and all that. Can you describe a few of these particular things that are helping to differentiate groups in America?
Well, you know, the key thing that we have going here is the answers to questions of all things about desirable qualities in children that we think kids ought to have. Whether kids ought to be independent or curious versus have respect for their elders or have good manners. Mm-hmm. Whether we think kids ought to be self-reliant and considerate, or whether it would be better if they were obedient or well-behaved. it's really amazing how those questions reveal their worldviews. And the interesting thing about it is those four questions, they didn't tell us anything about people's party identification in the 1990s or the 1980s or so forth. But these days, if a person wants independent kids who are curious, self-reliant, and considerate, they're almost wholly Democrats. And if people want kids who are respecting of their elders, have good manners, are obedient and well-behaved, they're almost all Republicans in this day and age. And just think about how fundamental that is to our lives. You know, do we want things that are organized in this sort of traditional hierarchical way, or do we want people to be able to pursue what they think is best? And that, of course, touches on all sorts of parts of our lives, not just politics. And that's another part of this book that's so important and why we have the title Prius or Pickup. Mm-hmm. It turns out the same types of people who are interested in driving new sort of different cars or drink, you know, sort of different coffee or things along those lines, those decisions match up with politics eerily well in this day and age.
So I want to try to understand a little bit about the timeline in an individual's life of how this works out. So back before I was in media, I was actually a political science graduate student. I worked with the World Values Survey, which gets at a little bit of what you're talking about you know, how children should be raised, things like that. And it's been done for decades. I mean, you know, I'm just saying it for the audience. In many different countries to try to map out generational shifts in these competing values. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm curious about is, are people, are parents like sort of thinking about how to raise their children based on the things they've thought about in terms of society and politics? Or are people being raised with these values and that is causing them to then think about political parties, political positions, things like that in that way? Like, where do you think the causality is here? Or is it just a reciprocal process?
Well, the way that we look at it, and I think this is right, is that there's no reason to think that these worldviews necessarily, whether what we call fixed or fluid on the opposite ends of this divide, that those things have actually changed very much. What's changed actually is politics and the types of things that our leaders make salient to us, make important to us in terms of our decision-making process. Back in a day when, you know, say we were wondering about, should we spend more on highways? Should we spend more on healthcare, education? Our worldviews wouldn't have anything to do with our preferences about those types of things. But as politics evolved to being about race and sexual orientation and gender and how to keep us safe from terrorism, the things that those worldviews capture, you know, how dangerous the world is, should we batten down the hatches against those types of threats, or is it safe to explore the world and things along those lines? That's what those worldview questions capture. So it's not necessarily that our parenting ideas have changed. It's that the worldviews that those capture now map eerily well onto politics.
And do you believe that that's just a natural evolution in American politics, or do you think that politicians are becoming more savvy and are consciously using, if not directly, your type of research, the general idea underlying it?
I don't think that there's any doubt about the fact that politicians are tapping into this dividing line. You know, where this started really was the 1960s. So this is, you know, where this whole process begins. Why did all of a sudden Republicans start to talk about race and gender equality and things along those lines, crime and punishment? Well, it's because they always lost elections. And so politicians decided, look, we have to change the way that people identify with the parties. We have to change the basis for which they do that. And that worked stunningly well for Republicans for quite a while. And now think about this present point in time. You know, Donald Trump's approach to politics taps into the preferences of fixed worldview people perfectly. And it's interesting, you know, we did an interview with with a journalist in Canada who is connected to the Trump campaign in some way, one of the operatives there. And he said, you know, what the Trump people were trying to identify in their supporters was people who had Old Testament values about punishment and crime. Mm-hmm. You know, this is exactly the kind of thing that we're talking about in this book. Those with fixed worldviews are concerned about people who are different from them, people who stand out from the norm. You know, certainly concerns about criminals and terrorists and immigrants and all these, you know, outsider types of people. This is exactly who Donald Trump is appealing to. And of course, Democrats are taking the reverse position on these things. And of course, the reasons that they are is, you know, they know who their supporters are. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the decisions politicians are making, you know, is deepening and widening, making this divide even worse.
So you've described this process. If we assume that this is not necessarily a good thing or a sustainable thing for either our culture or our politics, based on what you've learned through your research, what can we as individuals or members of the media or politicians actually do about it?
It's a really tough set of circumstances. I wish there was a perfect solution to this, but there honestly isn't. But so you think about how we ended up with this particular divide where our worldviews, you know, these sort of gut level reactions to politics have come to divide us. The reason is because of the things that our political leaders made important to us, you know, these hot button culture issues, you know, God, guns, things along those lines. The only way that's going to change is if the types of things that leaders make important to us change. They have to have incentives to do that, however. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have incentives to do it, they're not going to do it, because why do politicians choose the issues that they choose? To win elections. Yeah. And right now, it is so 50-50. Anybody taking a risk one way or the other risks, you know, losing big. And unless one side or the other falls into a real deficit, I think we're going to see more of the same, and it's going to continue to be as disquieting as the Kavanaugh hearings and everything else have been lately.
Okay, well, we're ending on a bit of a somber note, but at least we have some information that we can possibly iterate on. Mark Hetherington, thank you for joining us on the show, author of Prius or Pickup, available, very interesting book. I recommend everyone watching this that they take a look at it. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We come back, new information coming out in the disappearance or potentially the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. We're going to be breaking that down after this. I thought about it. No. Okay, welcome back, everyone. We considered continuing our conversation from the break, but it has nothing to do with anything.
I'm glad you brought up Only the Strong.
It's a great movie.
Starring Mark Dacascos.
Well, now we're doing it.
Never heard of.
Now
we're doing it. Like, oh, the capoeira movie in the high school?
A significant number of the people watching this have seen that movie. Anyway, we want to talk about a journalist who's disappeared. We'll talk about Only the Strong later.
Okay.
Anyway, so look, more details have been coming out over the past 48 hours or so about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. That's the Saudi-born, but U.S. living journalist and columnist for the Washington Post. So the Turkish government, which has been fairly certain for like 2 days now that a team that was dispatched from Saudi Arabia to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul did kill Jamal. They now say, by the way, that they have audio and video recordings that prove it. The recordings show that a Saudi security team detained him in the consulate after he walked in on October 2nd, then killed him and dismembered his body. One of the officials said, "You can hear his voice and the voices of men speaking Arabic. You can hear how he was interrogated, tortured, and then murdered." Now, we do not have any assurance yet that the U.S. or anyone from the U.S. has seen these recordings yet. And Turkey seems unwilling to release them because they are worried that it would compromise their techniques for spying on not just the Saudis inside Istanbul, but other diplomats as well. I can understand why they would want to hide that, although they've made it pretty much clear to all the governments that they're probably being spied on right now.
Yes, you're being spied on in that consulate. But I mean, this is just a shocking, intense, terrible story about a guy who on a personal level was going in to pick up his marriage license.
Yeah.
And people followed him in. I mean, it looks like the Turks are pretty certain that this guy was murdered. And they're like, don't just take our word for it. We have audio, we have video. And I did see reports that certain U.S. officials were shown it, but that was more like folks speaking on condition of anonymity, tell the Washington Post.
Yeah, so look, at some point they're going to have to reveal the specific information, or someone outside of the Turkish government is going to have to confirm that they have seen it. And it's definitely the case, because right now, some people who are in a position to actually provide some sort of consequences for what it appears that MBS and the Saudi government have done, they're sort of hiding behind the fact that it's not guaranteed yet. So Donald Trump has said a few things. I want to read a few of his comments. He said, "We're looking at it very strongly. We'll be having a report out soon. We're working with Turkey. We're working with Saudi Arabia. What happened is a terrible thing. Assuming that happened, I mean, maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised, but somehow I tend to doubt it."
This is a guy who has he has no idea what he's talking about at this point.
I think he doesn't remember two sentences in what the question was ever.
No, I think what he's thinking is, well, I've spent a lot of time with the Saudis, and I only think in terms of dollars and cents, and it seems like a good thing that we're making a lot of money off these military deals, off these arms deals that we're doing with the Saudis.
Yeah.
In his appearance, in that same appearance, I assume it was that same appearance, he mentioned multiple times the total amount of money that we are making in arms deals with the Saudis. And this is a more tangible case of what people were warning Trump against when he got all buddy buddy with the Saudis, which was like, listen, they do terrible things. And this is the moment where you're going to, at some point, I think inevitably, people are going to hear the sounds of this man, a permanent US resident, to answer the Trump question of where this guy lives.
Yeah, I'm gonna read one of those questions.
He's a permanent resident. They killed him.
Yeah.
They beat him to death, tortured him, and killed him.
Yeah.
So now you're gonna have, it's easy to face like, oh, Yemen, they're bombing a lot of children with our things. Yeah, but you don't see the children, you don't know the children. It's just like Yemen is FUBAR. But in this situation,
you're saying that's the popular perception, people will say.
Yemen's terrible. Yes. That's as much as people are willing to invest in terms of knowing about it, but they don't know the different sides. They don't know our partnership with the Saudis and how that works. But this is American resident murdered at hands of Saudis. Yeah. Here's the roll tape.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, so we obviously, one of the things we're pointing out is that we're providing a gigantic amount of weaponry to this country. And so should they get it or should they not get it? But when you think about the particulars of what we're talking about, should you give more weapons to a regime led by a man who will try to kidnap and kill a journalist? Let alone the bombing of kids in Yemen and the horrible campaign there. I would say that we should be really sure before we provide more weapons. We shouldn't only have a Kavanaugh level of certainty as the Republicans wanted.
Yeah, I'm more of, writing has been on the wall in this situation. This is,
we know what they'll do with the weapons.
We know what they do with, because what they've done with the weapons. But also we know that Trump's major foreign policy approach is one of America first. I don't care if people on other parts of the world are doing terrible things that run counter to the value system of America. And that was a large voting driver of people who'd seen us get into a lot of wars on foreign soil. And it's just going to be harder, and it should be harder for him to continue to do these things. They need to find who's responsible and put sanctions at the very least on those individuals who took part in it.
But we know what he thinks of most dictators. He doesn't generally see, he's in love with the leadership of North Korea, despite the, killing uncles with mortars and dogs and things. And so if you're thinking perhaps Trump will take this seriously, as you alluded to, he also said this, "It's in Turkey and it's not a citizen as I understand it. But a thing like that shouldn't happen. Again, this took place in Turkey, and to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a US citizen. Is that right?" So he looks to be attempting to get an out. I don't have to care because it's not a US citizen, even though it's a permanent resident who works for a US corporation, member of the media. But we know he doesn't care about people who come from other countries. He certainly doesn't care about the media. They're the enemy of the people. So anyway, that's certainly concerning. Other senators have been a little bit more willing to criticize Saudi Arabia. And look, if they took it seriously and were willing to go against Donald Trump, they could provide some sort of consequences.
What do you think the consequences are going to be?
Nothing.
Right.
I think there will be absolutely nothing.
I think there will be certain senators who put specific sanctions on people who are tangentially involved with this and not let them come to America for months.
Yeah.
And that'll be it.
Okay, I just want to very briefly mention this just because this is the last show of the week. But so yesterday we did a breakdown of Jair Bolsonaro, the possible or likely next president of Brazil, and his statements about the Afro-Brazilians and gay individuals and women and how he wants a dictatorship. And so I saw late last night, actually, that Brazil is trying to get a video game taken off of Steam. That is the PC game publishing platform. And the reason they're trying to take it off is because it is Bolsomito 2K18. And if you bring up this first picture, you're going to see, and it becomes very clear when you watch the promo materials, that Bolsomito is obviously supposed to be Bolsonaro. And in the game, you run through the streets of Brazil beating up women, members of the LGBT community, communists, and things like that. If you go to this next one, you're going to see, yeah, it's just beating women and gay furries, I think that's supposed to be. And it's got good reviews, oddly enough, despite the fact that it looks like trash. But it's obviously a sort of propaganda thing to get people who like him riled up. And the thing is, like, when it comes to Trump and when it comes to him, a lot of the supporters will say, you know, maybe I don't like those things he says about some of these groups, but you know, we think he has our interests at heart economically. They say that about Trump, but they certainly do seem to get fired up about that stuff in particular cases. Like, this is getting downloaded, people are paying for it, it's getting good reviews.
And we're encouraging this behavior abroad. America encourages this behavior abroad through our example of kind of propping up dictatorship. There also is a large nationalist sentiment where people are upset against folks that are different from them. But it's so weird in Brazil, which is one of the, if not the most diverse countries on the planet. Mm-hmm. That's what's so weird to me, that they would have this. And someone who's
that you would have a leader who is so violently opposed to almost any kind of diversity whatsoever. Yes. Yeah. So worrisome. Steam generally doesn't remove things, so good luck with that. By the way, don't play Bolsomito 2K18. It does not have my review. I do a lot of video game reviews in this show. This is not one of the ones that I'm recommending. Anyway, okay, so we're going to take another break. When we come back, Ken Klippenstein is going to be back on the show. He has uncovered some amazing details about one of Ted Cruz's top aides. He'll be talking about that after this. Welcome back, everyone. So very excited to welcome back to the show Ken Klippenstein of TYT Investigates. Every time he comes on the show, he's uncovered something amazing. Ken, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you here. So in this particular case, you have tracked down in an article titled, and this is amazing, "Cruz Aide Worked for Dictator, Now on Trial for Crimes Against Humanity," one of Senator Ted Cruz's aides who provided some legal help to the dictator Laurent Gbagbo. So who is the aide and who is this dictator? What are they alleged to have done?
So the aide's name is Omri Sarin, and he is Ted Cruz's national security advisor. Back in 2010, I found that he registered as a foreign agent of the Ivory Coast regime, which, you know, at the time that he was working for them, just followed the dictator's refusal to step down from power after decisively losing an election that, you know, rights groups and the international community pretty much had a consensus that he had lost. So essentially what he was doing was running PR for this government. The records aren't very specific about what he did, but given what the head of the, you know, PR firm, Lanny Davis at the time, that, you know, he was working as a subcontractor for, made clear at the time, they were basically running interference for the regime and trying to, you know, trying to make the case that, oh, maybe he should just stay in power, even though, you know, they lost the election.
Is that the same Lanny Davis involved in Donald Trump's defense?
Yep, that's the attorney of Donald Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. He also was the he was one of the top counsel for Bill Clinton. So he's a very politically heterodox figure and has kind of, you know, represented powerful people from both parties in the past.
Sometimes it seems like there's like six lawyers in the world. They just keep popping up. You know, Kavanaugh, if you look back, Kavanaugh represented everyone. It's really scary. Okay, so look, in terms of how bad this is that Omri Sarin was involved in this guy's legal trouble, what is that dictator alleged to have done? How bad are the crimes? How good is the evidence that they took place?
The evidence is overwhelming from human rights groups and, you know, monitors and the United Nations. You know, of course, he stands before the Hague right now for quote crimes against humanity. You know, which the crimes alleged were, you know, mass murder, rape, running child soldiers. So I would say the crimes are very serious, and the evidence seems overwhelming at this point.
Okay, so yeah, that looks pretty bad. Pretty much everything you'd imagine, you know, a horrific dictator would do, this person is alleged to have done. And to see U.S. lawyers, like, I understand, you know, the worst people still have legal representation, but
right.
It is bizarre that U.S.-based legal teams are like flocking over there to provide this defense. I assume because he has a lot of money. But I am curious, in terms of how bad this looks, part of it is going to be how important is he to Ted Cruz historically? And what is Ted Cruz's approach or response to dictators of this sort been, if that came up in your research?
Well, Ted Cruz likes to talk a lot about, you know, the Christians besieged in various countries in the Middle East, you know, of which there may be some, you know, Syria, for instance, Egypt in some cases with the Copts there. But you see that his concern is very selective and may not, you know, indeed be about Christians, because there are many Christians in Ivory Coast, which is the country that, you know, his national security advisor was working for at the time. And this wasn't just legal representation. This appears to have been public relations. Yes. To try to, you know, defend them politically. So I would say that Cruz's concern about rights abroad and in regimes like this is superficial at best.
Yeah, and to have him as your national security advisor, is he still working for Ted Cruz?
Yes, he actually just got hired by him a few months ago. I believe it was in April of this year.
And of course, Ted Cruz obviously still thinks that at some point he could be president. So if this is the sort of person surrounding himself, that is worrisome. So thank you for helping to uncover that, Ken.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on again.
Thank you. Anytime. Okay, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, the most important news of the week. Did you know who had lunch with Donald Trump yesterday and what they said? We'll break it down after this. Welcome back, everyone. Let's close out the week with something a little bit fun. Everybody at this point knows that Kanye West had lunch with Donald Trump. Lunch, which was kind of just like a crazy rant that usually takes place on like a bus, but it happened instead at the Oval Office with Kanye West, celebrated, you know, award-winning musician, banging his fists like Khrushchev on the desk.
On the Resolute desk.
The Resolute desk. Well, he was resolute.
He was quite resolute. That's what he did. It's just like no one was in the corner being like, don't, it's old. It's old, Kanye.
Mm-hmm. So look, I want to talk about this because it's interesting and it's how the president literally spent his day. I acknowledge that many people say that this isn't worthy of coverage. Well, it is literally the last thing we're getting to this week. So let off, we want to have some fun. Before we get into the video, which we do have video of, I saw CNN, and I don't think it was Chris Saliza, so it's okay to use it. CNN put together a bullet point list of some of the points that were raised here that I just think is awesome. So let's bring that up. You can see.
I think it was Nia Malika, by the way.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
His MAGA hat makes him feel like a superhero. He wants the flyest cars. Kids should play basketball while they are doing math, which would be difficult. But, I mean, maybe multitasking is important. Time doesn't exist, which we talked about yesterday.
Good.
Stop worrying about the future. We only have today, which really undercuts a lot of the other points if you're not supposed to be worried about any day but today. Stop and frisk is bad. Hey, that's good. We did, you know, a list of American politics on that this week. And then on the next one, you're going to see the solution to police brutality is love. I don't know who's supposed to be loving, maybe everybody. Something about an I-plane. I love that it's just something about an I-plane.
The I-plane, we have video of that, sort of. Mm-hmm. But the I-plane is a hydrogen-powered jet that replace Air Force One. But it went into a tangent about how the president should have the freshest planes.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he means that hydrogen is less polluting.
He does.
Thus fresher.
He means
it. So look, the hydrogen plane is a good idea. Fine. Maybe Trump will now put $10 billion into developing it.
You can read all the bullet points you want, John. Mm-hmm. But
okay, let's.
But it's seeing that is believing.
Okay, well, you've got a video list there. What are we looking at?
Well, I'll just say what we labeled them. Kanye Adidas. Here is Kanye talking to the president about Adidas and his business dealings.
Right now, you gave me the heart to go to Adidas, because at Adidas, when I went in 2015, we were a $14 billion company losing $2 billion a year. Now we have a $38 billion market cap. It's called the Yeezy effect. So I had the balls, because I had enough balls to put on this hat. I mean, this Adidas thing made me a billionaire, and I could have lost $200 million walking away from that deal.
Isn't he saying that happened long before the hat?
No, previous to the hat, Since time doesn't exist, John, mm-hmm. he could tell that there would be a faux time mm-hmm. where he would have this hat, and that retroactively initiated mm-hmm. His balls, mm-hmm. gave him balls. So I'm just saying that Kanye used to not have balls, and now he has balls.
That's what he is saying.
A future MAGA hat he yeah. would eventually have. Yeah. And I apologize for using tenses. I'd like to apologize to Kanye for using tenses, future, past.
It implies that time exists,
it
which it doesn't.
Time, and I don't want to do that.
Look, I don't know the facts in terms of whether Adidas did better, did worse, whatever. I'm just going to take him at his word that he came in and it's doing much better. That right there, fine, good. If you can come in and make a corporation like Adidas do much better, that is good, that is to your credit. Maybe you use that to help convince the president to do something. It's all the other stuff around it about hats and balls and stuff and saying that for some reason, putting on a hat or spouting off a political talking point or a slogan or whatever has anything to do with that business success that becomes a little bit more problematic. And also that you're delivering it in the form of a rant, basically. Like your business success, and obviously he's a smart guy and he's done extremely well for himself. Like all of that makes you fully qualified, I think, to consult with the president. It's the craziness around it that becomes a bit of an issue.
I'm glad you brought up intelligence, IQ, et cetera. Kanye also wanted to share with people his IQ size score. And then reasons he didn't necessarily score in the top percentile on all the tests, but he'll explain how he gets better.
I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was connected with a neuropsychologist that works with the athletes in the NBA and the NFL. And he looked at my brain. It's equal on three parts. I'm going to go ahead, drop some bombs for you. 98 percentile IQ test. I had a 75 percentile of all human beings, but it was counting eight numbers backwards after it was repeating. So I'm going to work on that one. The other one's 98%, Tesla, Freud. You know, so he said that I actually wasn't bipolar, I had sleep deprivation, which could cause dementia 10 to 20 years from now, where I wouldn't even remember my son's name. So all this power that I got, and I'm taking my son to the Sox game and all that, I wouldn't be able to remember his name from a misdiagnosis.
Okay.
It's Jim Brown's my favorite. Jim Brown's in the back. Mm-hmm. Just like...
Yeah.
Just not saying anything, being like, I have an excuse because I played football if I have any mental, you know, degradation or whatever. What's your excuse, Kanye?
Yeah.
If he was diagnosed with bipolar, mm-hmm. that is a very real thing.
I have family members that are bipolar, yes.
And all this does is encourage. All it does is, I have no idea. I guess I understand why. The reason that you bring Kanye West into the Oval Office is because you want everyone to see that Kanye West is on your side. Mm-hmm. And he's now a jewel in your crown, mm-hmm. and you're parading him around as such. The question is, does everyone on seeing Kanye do this diatribe, mm-hmm. then everyone that Trump sought to gain the favor of and show Kanye off in front of, did they see through it?
Well, look, Hannity said it was great. And Fox News, they edited it to within an inch of its life to make it seem like it was just a discussion of policy. So the right-wing punditry is presenting it as a good thing, whether they actually think that this was a productive or helpful thing. And honestly, like, I want to ask you a question. Like, so we see the point of view of the camera looking at Kanye. Across the desk from him is presumably Donald Trump. What is Donald Trump thinking about Kanye West as he's ranting there? Do you really think it's positive stuff?
Well, in this situation, this next video, you'll be able to see Donald Trump's reaction.
Okay.
This is Kanye Superman. Okay. I think you can see him.
I love Hillary. I love everyone, right? But the campaign, I'm with her, just didn't make me feel as a guy that didn't get to see my dad all the time, like a guy that could play catch with his son. It was something about when I put this hat on, it made me feel like Superman. You made a Superman. That's my favorite superhero. And you made a Superman cape. For me, also as a guy that looks up to you, looks up to Ralph Lauren, looks up to American industry guys. Non-political, no bullshit. Put the beep on it, however you want to do it, 5 seconds delay, and just goes in and gets it done.
Look, when you do that angle, yes, you see the president, but you also see all of those the photographers and the people taking the video. And honestly, that just, I feel really bad.
For who? In what way?
I don't know.
Reality. You just feel bad.
No, I feel really
feels bad, man. Feels
because
bad.
Look, in the abstract, it's a very funny situation. But in reality, I don't like mocking the fact that this is clearly a person that is having issues. You can see it in all of these statements. I don't think that that's funny at all. But he's in that position. It's being exploited by Donald Trump and the right wing right now. Look, he's free to. He's an individual. He can go wherever he wants. He can say whatever he wants. As we were saying earlier in the week with the Taylor Swift thing, every celebrity is fully within their rights to talk about politics. It's just that we then get to listen. And sometimes it doesn't look great.
Yeah, it doesn't look great. But I think Trump takes a lot of meetings like this, where he's just sitting across the desk from someone who he doesn't understand. But he can't make a face. He keeps the poker face going.
I just feel a little bit bad. And I like to think of if it was a different president, how they could be spending their time. Okay, well, thank you, Brett, for coming in. Always good to have you here. Thank you for watching both today and all this week. Next week, so much more. Buckle up. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.